KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Let's see, if we go from Juno to Transcendence, what do those things have in common besides the fact that they are movies? They start off as scripts that made their way into the legendary Blacklist. Its co-founder and my longtime friend, Franklin Ennis, sitting across from me. Franklin, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I always often thought, rather, you should call this the Dream Factory because there's so much hope attached to some of these scripts. And when I've talked to people and I tell them I was going to be talking to you on the show, oh my God, I just love that. And the subtext is they love it as an entity because it says that there is not only a conduit, but a resting place for these things that have real quality.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hope. And I think that the more that we can do to shine a very bright spotlight on people doing ambitious and really high-quality work, the more likely it is that those get made. You know, I think that really the role that we play is to shine that very bright spotlight and say, hey, here's a bunch of stuff that, you know, maybe you overlooked, maybe you loved it, but you didn't pull the trigger on it for whatever reason. It might be worth taking a second look. And I think that's oftentimes what happens at the end of the year when the list comes out. There are meetings all over around town sort of going through the list and making sure that people didn't miss anything the first time around. And hopefully it gives a lot of these projects sort of renewed energy. You know, I think of the list as a catalyst a lot of times for these projects because it focuses people's attention on them. And the hope is that someone who hadn't read it does read it, and that person has enough power to actually make that film happen.
What I love about Blacklist is, being a person of color like yourself, you want to use this, first of all, as a way to reclaim the word black.
Yeah. I have a very distinct memory of being in fifth or sixth grade in West Central Georgia and, you know, being explained color symbolism in literature and being told that, you know, if you see a cowboy with a black hat, they're probably the bad guy, and a cowboy with a white hat, they're probably the good guy. And I remember thinking even then, like, I don't like the way this is going. And so I think at the time I said, you know, one day I'm going to write a novel that just completely inverts that. And obviously I haven't done that yet, nor probably will I. But I do look for ways to subtly invert that paradigm whenever I can. And I certainly didn't realize that the list would become what it did. But even in the initial sort of offering of it, I thought it would be at least an amusing idea for me. And it's proven to be a little bit more than that.
As you're saying this, one of the things that links a lot of these scripts, because I spent the past couple of weeks reading a bunch of them, is a number of them do sort of seem to subvert convention.
Yeah, they do. And I think that's interesting. I mean, I think the other thing that I think is really sort of remarkable about the list is, and again, we're providing a platform essentially for the industry as a whole, or at least the gatekeepers within the industry, to express the things that they're enthusiastic about. So it's very easy, I think, for folks sort of who are part of the film-going audience to say, Hollywood is ridiculous. All they do is make franchises and sequels. But if you ask the people that are working in the industry, what are the scripts that they truly love? A very high percentage of them are very unconventional, very emotionally ambitious, and do subvert a lot of narrative and sort of storytelling conventions that you wouldn't expect to see from Hollywood. And I think that reflects, what that means essentially for me is that a lot of those decisions about franchises and sequels are economically driven and not driven by, you know, folks' legitimate desire to make very special films. It's just that the economic model for doing so has gotten more difficult, and so it's harder to get them done.
But a number of these scripts have got made.
Yes.
A shocking number have got made. And some of them have been sort of hammered into more conventional movie ideas.
Yes, by certainly studios. They have.
And yeah. That's fascinating for me, too, to have gone back and read some of those things, some of which I weren't aware had started on a Blacklist, but they end up getting right down to the title change that sort of says, hey, this is a big studio movie you're watching here.
It's true. And I think that reflects the economic pressures. You know, you start with something that you truly love, and then you try to adjust it into something that's viable in the marketplace. And, you know, compromises get made. Oftentimes that means the film is not as special as it would have been otherwise.
We can go to a case like what became Cop Out.
Yeah.
Which started
a great
as
example.
A couple of dicks.
And
that's, it was built in the first 20 pages to sort of say, this is what you think you're seeing, and this is not what you're going to get.
That's exactly right. And, you know, in the process of sort of making it a studio film, it changed pretty dramatically. And you go from the title, A Couple of Dicks, to Cop Out and all the changes that that implies.
But I guess it makes me want to ask you, though, do you lose hope a little bit when you see that some of these things do get sort of funnel into much more conventional thinking, and you can sort of see the thing that they're built on just completely implode underneath them?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think that causes me to lose any more hope than just the reality of the economics of the business. I think that unfortunately that I've been working in the industry long enough to know that that is oftentimes part and parcel of the process of making films. But at the same time, you know, for every one of those, there are films like Juno or like Lars and the Real Girl or Argo or The King's Speech that are very much what they began as. And I think that gives me much more hope than that hope is sort of enervated by the few that sort of get corrupted or compromised along the way.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to Franklin Leonard, the founder of The Blacklist, not the McCarthy Blacklist, but the Blacklist that really connotes optimism. And just knowing you the way I do, I mean, you call yourself judgmental, but you really almost that Balzacian sort of definition of a cynic, which inside means the beats the heart of a true romantic.
That very well described. No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I came to Hollywood because, you know, I look at films. I mean, some of my favorite films are like Being There and Amadeus, and those are films that are not made often now, those types of films.
In fact, made by two studios that really don't, one literally doesn't exist anymore, yeah, and the other doesn't exist in the way, in the incarnation which was created.
Exactly. But I do believe that that the people who work in this industry, the vast majority of them wish that they could make films like that. And I think that what we're trying to capture and sort of what continues to excite me about the film industry is that there's always the potential for films like that to get made. It's one of the reasons I love going to the Toronto Film Festival and Sundance Film Festivals every year is because when you go into a theater and the lights go down, there is a chance that one of those films is going to be that. And there really is quite no other feeling like sitting in a darkened theater with a bunch of people that you don't know and wanting to lean over to the person next to you and say, this is as good as I think it is, isn't it? And so I think on some level I'm always chasing that high, and to the extent that I can be helpful in those things getting made is kind of why we do what we do.
But now I want to stress this. This didn't begin for you as a business consideration.
Not at all. No.
I mean, again, it really comes out of this almost, I hate to use the word altruistic, but completely optimistic bent you have towards finding good stuff.
I would go even further. I think it started initially as an almost an entirely selfish pursuit. You know, I was working for Leonardo DiCaprio's production company. My job was to find good screenplays and good writers. I felt like I was not doing a very good job of it, and I wanted to find some good scripts to read over the holidays. And so I took a survey of my peers and said, send me a list of your 10 favorite scripts that won't be in production by the end of the year, and in exchange, I'll send you the aggregated list. It seemed like the most efficient way to get people to actually participate. And I sort of slapped a vaguely subversive name on it and went on vacation and didn't think anything of it. And when I came back, it had been forwarded back to me several dozen times, and I realized that I'd sort of accidentally created a thing. And then in the years following, I'd sort of done it somewhat altruistically. But again, I mean, I think for me, it was as much about me finding good writers and good scripts as part of my job as it was sort of providing this thing for other folks.
My guest, who has just turned this into a whole epistemological conversation, is Franklin Leonard. He's the founder of The Blacklist. This is The Treatment. You really are curious about the creative mind. And
yes,
so many of the conversations I've had with you have been just about talking about these scripts as a way that they manifest for these writers, that they offer some insight into that personality.
Yeah, for sure. You know, so many of the scripts that end up on the list are from writers who I hadn't heard of prior to the list coming out. And so what I think was also really interesting about the list is you begin to see these sort of trends about sort of what's existing, I guess, in a collective unconscious mind. And you end up seeing sort of these trends from brand new writers, but they're writing things similar thematically. I mean, there were two scripts about the making of Jaws on last year's list. There were two scripts about Mr. Rogers on last year's list. There are years when there are literally a dozen political thrillers based on real-life political figures. For whatever reason, you see a lot of writers right now trying to reckon with the reality of the way in which politics is lived now, oftentimes by taking stories from decades ago and interpreting them through a contemporary lens.
One of the things that's really fascinating to me about having gone over so many of these scripts is so many of them are about powerlessness and people trying to seize power for themselves.
Yeah, you can make the argument that that's just sort of the natural position of a writer in the industry and that they're trying to reckon with that, which is something that I've never really understood. I think that writers are probably the most undervalued parts of the process in the film industry. It sort of boggles the mind. Without a writer, you've got nothing to shoot and you've got nothing for the actors to say. And certainly it's possible to make a bad movie from a good script, but good luck making a good movie from a bad script. But yeah, no, I think it's reflective of our time. I mean, I think that the reality is that, you know, every year that goes by, I think especially in American culture, but I think around the world, there's a greater gap between those who have power and those who don't. And I think if, as an artist, you're trying to explore the human condition, unfortunately, the experience of powerlessness and trying to fight against that is a seminal aspect of it.
It's interesting, too, because I don't know how far back you can go with this, but when I first came here in the late 80s, there were still magazines like American Film that existed.
Yeah.
That every once in a while, once a year, in fact, will have the 10 best unproduced screenplays.
Yeah, I've been informed of that since The Blacklist started, but yeah.
In that day, it was almost about those scripts being used as a way to get writers work.
Yeah.
And this seems to be much more, The Blacklist seems to be much more mated to the idea of a real practical function, which is to sort of get these movies made. And the scripts tend not to be as ambitious in scope, but much more ambitious in emotional terms.
I think that's right. I think, well, it's interesting. I think that the list has dual purposes. I think it's about sort of, you know, being a catalyst to getting those scripts turned into films. But I also do think that it has a fair amount of influence in terms of getting these writers' jobs. And I think if only because everyone, after the list comes out, everyone goes and reads these scripts. They're now informed of a writer maybe they didn't know before and the talent that they have. And there certainly are scripts that are wildly ambitious that for whatever reason are going to struggle to get made. Some of that is rights issues, going back to the two Making of Jaws movies that were on the list last year. I'm reminded of a script called Whalemen about a whaling community in 13th century.
That's why I brought up Harrow Alley.
Yeah.
It's like, who would even sit down to think to put this on paper?
Exactly. And I was actually with the author of that script, Tucker Parsons, last week. And it is an amazing script. But the idea of getting a cast and crew up to the North Sea and shooting for presumably 8 months, the vast majority of which in the water, which would be quite frigid. I mean, from a production perspective, I don't know who's doing it. And also the reality of a studio trying to sell a movie set in, you know, the 13th century about, you know, whaling. I'd love to meet the marketing chief that knows for certain he can sell that, or he or she can sell that to an audience. But, you know, it's a beautiful script, and I think it taps into something sort of, you know, distinctly sort of in our reptilian brain about, you know, our families and sort of what lengths we're willing to go to protect them, and what lengths we're willing to go to protect our lifestyles.
But also this thing that links a lot of Blacklist scripts for me, that sort of disconnect between practicality, which is just sort of keeping your families and community alive, and pursuit of this dream.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I think that's, again, reflective of the position of a lot of writers who are, you know, sort of who end up on the list. You know, every year, and one of the things I think is most remarkable about the list, you know, there's every year there's like the complaint that comes up like, oh, The Blacklist used to be like so cool. It was about discovering new writers. And now it's just about, you know, fetting Aaron Sorkin. And I joke about that being the hipster complaint. Like, you know, I was into Radiohead, but I can't listen to it anymore because everybody else listens to them. But what's remarkable about the list is that every year you have a bunch of names that no one knows or that very few people know unless you're, you know, really focused on brand new writers working in the industry. And then you have folks like Sorkin and Benioff and Quentin Tarantino. So I think a lot of these writers are brand new. I think they're probably reckoning with the question of, do I pursue this dream or of being a writer, or do I do the responsible thing and take care of my family or my eventual family? And that gets translated into their storytelling in terms of the themes and the subject matter in which they choose. But I think it's special that you have writers who are, you know, effectively nobodies in the industry on the same list and oftentimes above guys who are household names even outside the industry. And I think it legitimizes the new work in a way that a list of all newbies never could.
We have to take a break. My guests were just connected, Aaron Sorkin and Radiohead, so I guess everything is in its right place now. It's Franklin Leonard, founder of The Blacklist. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back. We just had kind of an in-between chat about Newsroom with my guest, Franklin Leonard, founder of The Blacklist. It's the treatment. I think, though, getting back to these threats that I see in the list, some of these are about outsiders who are trying to decide if they want to purchase or make purchase into the way back into the center.
Look, I think the best storytelling, and I scripts among this, but are those things that talk about what it means to be human fundamentally. And I think that these are big questions that we ask ourselves. And I think especially for writers, particularly those at this stage of their career, I think it's unsurprising that thematically this comes up time and time and time and time again. In fact, I'd be probably surprised if it didn't manifest itself. But what I think is really amazing is the varied ways in which those themes sort of, you know, rise. Like, and again, we go back to, like, you know, 13th century whaling. You've got, I mean, Lars and the Real Girl is sort of like that. And I don't know that it's very possible to get two different stories in terms of size and scope and sort of subject matter that are essentially about the same thing on some level. But yeah, I think it's, as somebody who's always considered himself an outsider and wants to sort of class himself with outsiders and constantly sort of wrestle with the issues of, do you try to purchase movement inside or do you try to dismantle the inside from the outside or from sort of some weird intermediate location? I'm glad to see that. I think those are the scripts that I most identify with and certainly the ones that personally I respond to.
Yeah, because knowing you as I do, I know that part of this, I don't want to say struggle, but question you continually ask yourself is, I want to make a change, but by virtue of becoming a part of that, and the Blacklist is now an institution. By virtue of becoming an institution, am I changed by virtue of becoming somebody who's moved in that enough that I lose sight of what it is I wanted to do?
Yeah, I think you, you know, it's the row. I don't want to lend myself to the evil which I condemn. But I think there's a risk, and I guess this goes back to Weber a little bit, of as you sort of become an institution, you end up getting bureaucratized and sort of any sort of charismatic leadership or sort of effervescent leadership ends up getting transformed into something very bureaucratic. And I definitely want to avoid that. But I think that, again, I think the difference for us is that what we've done is create a platform that I think people are able to use in myriad different ways. Like, I don't love every script that's on the list every year, but it's not my choice. It really is a survey of the industry as a whole. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we do is, you know, hold up a mirror to the industry itself and say, this is what you love. Is this what you're making? And I think we do a very good job of being consistently transformative in that way. But again, I don't think it's us the ones doing the transforming. I think it's the industry saying, oh, here's a bunch of stuff that maybe we overlooked. Let's go back and revisit that and maybe we'll end up making it.
I guess what I found interesting in a lot of what you were saying in the first half of the show is when I told people I was doing, and they, oh, well, you know, when he started the Blacklist, it was about these scripts that were really kind of plot free and more anecdotal. And I said, no, that's not the case.
Not the case at all.
Because I found when I've been talking to people about this, that they think what you're seeking to do, and I know you well enough to know this is not the case, is to try to create a kind of commodification. I said, no. That's truly not what he's doing.
Yeah. No, it's not at all. I mean, it really is very simple. We're taking a survey of what people love and sharing that survey with everyone. And there's there's definitely no goal to commodify. If anything, like I said, our goal is actually very simple. It is to shine a very bright spotlight on great screenwriting and in doing so be a tide that can raise all boats in the industry, especially the boats of writers and most especially the boats of great writers.
I find it interesting too, though, that the list tends to attract, just because it's an abstraction and that you're looking at a script and not meeting with people, it tends to collect the most varied group of people I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's a pretty varied group, for sure.
Must love that.
Oh, absolutely. There are folks, I mean, I think my favorite example of this is the year that The Social Network was number two on the list, which has, you know, been used as a, oh, well, you're just talking about these, you know, scripts that are already going to get made and you take credit for them. And it's not the case. But I think what's amazing about it is the number one script on the list that year was written by a writer named Chris Weeks, who at the beginning of that calendar year was living in Australia, wasn't represented. He wrote a Jim Henson biopic based only on research he had done on the internet. And that script ends up number one on the list above, you know, an Aaron Sorkin script that would go on to win the Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. And the Henson, you know, company, I think, has optioned Chris's script as the basis for an eventual Jim Henson biopic. you know, without Sorkin as number two on that list, Weeks's sort of script is inherently less interesting to everybody else, because if you know the Sorkin script is that good, you're certainly going to wonder what the deal with this this Muppet Man script is.
It's the treatment, I guess, it's Franklin Leonard. He's founder of the Blacklist. I guess, though, getting back to what I was asking a moment ago,
yeah.
As people of color, we know that we're judged as soon as we walk into a room.
That's absolutely right.
That having something that relieves people of the necessity of having to make physical judgment.
Yep.
Is, I know, something you wanted to do with this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it extends to our to the website as well, which allows, you know, writers from all over the world to submit their material and have it evaluated just on the basis of the script. Like, the script is the thing that is all that matters. And we even go so far on the website as to allow you to sort of, you know, put your material up under a pen name. So, Yeah. So on the gender question, on the race question, on any of it, there is no reason for anyone to know or have any expectation of what you look like. And you're actually free to manipulate that expectation however you'd like, because the script should be the thing. Like, I mean, great storytelling can come from anywhere. And I think that, and for me, it's as much of a sort of moral and ethical case in terms of that diversity and removing all of those elements from consideration as it is a business one. I think that the industry leaves a colossal amount of money on the table by making assumptions based on conventional wisdom that by this point should have been proven incorrect. This idea that, well, the only way you could possibly be a good screenwriter is if you were willing to pick up your life and move to Los Angeles and sort of work, a low-paying job in order to get your script into somebody's lap, that makes no sense. There is no correlation between your willingness or ability to do that and your being a great writer. You know, your racial background, your gender background, those things have nothing to do with your ability to deliver a great screenplay. So let's do our best to remove those elements and then evaluate it based on the script itself. And by the way, I can continue this rant into so many different elements of the film industry and, frankly, other industries as well. But for me, the real focus is, I guess on some level, I just want to see a bunch of really good different movies. And the best way to do that is to sort of clear out all of the obstructions that prevent that from happening.
And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on was to have you talk about that, because you don't really get asked that very much.
I don't,
no. And I want to take the time to read a bunch of these scripts, and I went through about 40 of them just to get ready for this. And because I really want to understand what this does. And to me, it's the radical thing that doesn't really get spoken. And it's, to me, I said altruism early in the, because this feels like more political movement than anything else. And I just wonder if it came out of a sense of foment in you to basically sort of break down the barricades.
Yeah, I think that is an element of my worldview and personality that certainly exists.
It's how you're built.
Yeah, it probably is. I mean, look, if I weren't doing this, I would probably be working for the Southern Poverty Law Center or doing a fair amount of my own political activism. Yeah, no, I think it comes from, I think my doing this comes from two places. One is a genuine desire to see these sort of vestiges of conventional wisdom born of
laziness.
Yeah, that's sort of fundamentally the issue, right?
We can say inertia, but it's really laziness.
Yeah, no, but it's really laziness. But I think I understand where that laziness comes from, and actually maybe laziness isn't the right word.
Let's say inertia.
Yeah, inertia. I mean, it's the industry has constructed itself in a very specific way. There were rational reasons why it constructed itself in that way, but I think...
Do you really feel like those are rational reasons?
I think going back decades, yes, and I think they calcified. You know, if you're an agent or you're a studio executive and there are thousands of people who are writing screenplays and they're constantly trying to get them to you, the rational response to a limited amount of time and a superabundance of material is to try to filter out those things that are coming from sources that you've gotten good material from before, that are coming from, you know, sources that bear the traditional markings of quality. I think that But there's a better way now.
I think there's always been a better way. What we're talking about is people probably relying on those traditional funnels.
Right. They're relying on those traditional funnels. And so we're going to provide them a way that is better, not just theoretically, but on its face. And I think that technology allows us to do that. I mean, I think you could have done something like the Blacklist prior to email, but it wasn't as easy to do. It's significant to me, sort of timing-wise and sort of, world historic timeline-wise, that the first Blacklist went viral in the industry the same weekend that Lazy Sunday went viral from Saturday Night Live, which, you know, is sort of crazy, but it's I think it reflects...
It's an epochal moment.
It's an epochal moment. It's right. It's like all of a sudden, and if you look at sort of the way in which technology and the way people share information has changed even since that moment, it's been dramatic. So you have this moment in 2005 where the blacklist goes viral within the industry, and I think that was a relatively early moment of industry-wide sharing of information. Since then, iPhones, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, I mean, the notion of sort of collaborative consumption online and collaborative information sharing has changed dramatically. And I think that's what in many ways facilitates what we're doing now, which is a sort of real-time version of that, where, you know, if I'm a director or producer, I can go online and search for scripts that are set in China that have a car chase and a female protagonist between the age of 25 and 34. And if such a script exists, you know, you're going to see that on our website. But I don't think that anyone, necessarily would have used that 10, 15 years ago. And technologically, I'm not sure it would have been possible. And it certainly wouldn't have been possible to create as easily as it has been for us over the last 2 years.
But as you're saying all these things, there have been attempts in the past, even concurrent with what you're doing with the blacklist, to codify and categorize all this information.
Yeah.
Because, and I'm glad you admitted here, there is an implicit politic in what you're doing. I think that was the uniting element of all of this.
Yeah. Well, I think that, I think there's two elements that sort of have allowed us to sort of move forward in the way that we have. The first is that I think that for the most part, people embrace the political thrust of what we're doing. I think that on a fundamental level, and I hear it, you know, in one-on-one conversations all the time, you know, from folks that you wouldn't even necessarily expect would even get it, much less support it, that they really applaud that's what's happening and the movement behind it.
So they want to be liberated of this groupthink.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But in many ways, too, I mean, look, the blacklist is sort of inverting the groupthink in another direction, right? Like we're saying, here's all of these scripts that everyone loves that on their face are not, you know, what you should be making. And all of a sudden, people are saying, wow, well, if everybody loves it, I should be making this script about, you know, a guy who buys a sex doll.
But by virtue of what you're doing with this, I'm sorry to mean to interrupt.
No, that's right.
You're making it democratic rather than being a kind of institutional thing.
Yeah, I think that is definitely an element of it. But I think people are intrigued by that. I think people, you know, they don't necessarily want to make decisions sort of based on the hierarchical model that exists and the sort of ladder model that exists in the industry. They're looking for additional sources of information, and they're looking for ways that their instincts about something can be confirmed either to themselves or to their bosses. And then I think the other element that's allowed us to do what we have is that, you know, I think it comes from a very sincere place. Like, I have a genuine admiration, and frankly, I'm often in awe of the writers that I read and the writers that create these stories that I want to pay money and go sit in a dark room to see. And I think that people recognize that, and they see that that's ultimately what animates what the blacklist is and what it does. And I think as long as that's the case, I think we'll be given a relatively wide berth to figure out how we can do more along those lines.
I can't believe it, but we're out of time. You've got to come back into the show again.
I would love to.
My guest is Franklin Leonard. He's the combative founder of The Blacklist, recording engineer. I'm glad she's back. It's J.C. Swadek. The show's mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm still unproduced. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.